Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. John Zmirak is a senior editor of The Stream and author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism, which is a lethally clever, true and well-informed expose of the shallower and more off-putting aspects of the Catholic faith. What is The Stream? Well, it describes itself as a rich and reliable source for breaking news, analysis and inspiration, a champion for life, freedom and unity in the body of Christ, and it was launched to equip Christians to think clearly about moral, political and economic issues of the day. The Stream brings together many voices from amongst evangelicals, Catholics and Orthodox Christians, and offers what it claims is deep wisdom and insight through original content, the best across the web. You can look it up and judge for yourself. John's also authored a dozen books, but The Politically Incorrect Guide is one of the most influential. A reviewer wrote, quote, "It becomes clear as one reads on that this book is not so much an evangelical tool as it is a weapon against the absurdities of liberal Catholicism. It's a combat manual for warriors against heresies, soft and hard. And in this, it succeeds admirably." Well, after the recent deeply upsetting hijacking of St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York for the funeral of a trans activist called Cecilia Gentili, whom the close mourners described as the great whore, St. Cecilia, the mother of all whores, to the ribald delight of the crowd and the tickling of the fancy of the priest who presided, Father Edward Doherty, who seemed unfazed by the raucous irreverence, I wanted to get some help in understanding what had actually taken place. The cathedral authorities claimed they were deceived. The mourners claimed that they weren't, and, moreover, claimed that Fiducia Supplicans was their inspiration and legitimization. Perhaps this disturbing event functions as a microcosm of Catholicism in America at the moment. And so I asked John Zmirak if he would help us decode it and interpret how it reflects the wider civil wars between progressive and faithful Catholicism in America. Our discussion ranges over a great deal of material, and perhaps this is the moment to take a leaf out of the progressive handbook and offer a trigger warning. If you are prone to suffer from occasional fits of theological or political apoplexy, or perhaps mild or crippling Trump derangement syndrome, be advised. This conversation may not be for you, and I'm delighted to be joined by John Zmirak. John, it's great to see you. Thank you for joining me here. I've admired you for a very long time. I love your books. I love your writing. I'm very glad we're on the same side. I'd hate to be on the opposite side from you. So it's really good to have you here. You are the senior editor at stream.org, S-T-R-E-A-M. Look it up. And you're based in New York?
No, I'm based in Dallas, Texas. I'm a native New Yorker, but I know when to jump off a sinking ship, and I now live in Texas.
So this is the best of both worlds. You live in the right place, and you have all the information on the wrong place. And we need to go to the wrong place, because one of the reasons I'm talking to you is in the wake of my having written what I hoped were excoriating articles about the Anglican misuse of cathedrals by turning them into hedonistic nightclubs, lo and behold, a week later, St. Patrick's appears to invite a transvestite prostitute funeral in which the congregation essentially take over the liturgy. And the optics of this are so bad, but I've tried to point out that this wasn't directly sponsored by the Catholic hierarchy at St. Patrick's in New York. However, we hear different things. We hear that they were told, then we hear they didn't know. The priest who camped up the liturgy appears to be completely committed to the whole project. Our listeners are going to be confused about exactly who did what to whom. Can you give us the explanation? Because I know you know.
This was a giant gay celebration using the cathedral intentionally as a provocation and also a kind of victory dance. This was a victory dance of the LGBTQ, My Name is Legion lobby over the fallen body of Christendom.
And presumably on the back of Fiducia Supplicans, at least they said it was.
That's right. That's right. So the gay lobby is driven by its own self-loathing. These people are violating the law written on the human heart. And if Christianity had never been preached, If Judaism had never been preached, these people would still feel troubled because it is written on our hearts that this is not what the human body is for. The human body is not meant to be surgically mutilated. We see in the transgender surgeries and hormonal treatments, they're basically reviving the ancient cult of Cybele. That was the goddess who demanded that its priests castrate themselves. These are old demons, okay? Jonathan Cahn, an American Messianic Jew, has written a great book called The Return of the Gods, where he argues that the gods of the pagans are demons. Certainly the gods of the Canaanites were. And those demons were kind of silenced for 2,000 years by Christianity. Now, with the weakening of Christianity, they're coming back and they're demanding worship in the same fashion they were worshipped in the ancient world. Moloch is demanding infant sacrifice. Whatever demon went under the name of Moloch, whatever demon went under the name of Cybele is demanding self-castration. So on the one hand, you have preternatural spirits demanding worship. And then you have individual human beings who are tormented by whatever their personal experience is. They're trapped in this addictive and sinful lifestyle, and their conscience is accusing them. And they're looking for scapegoats. They're saying, oh, you Catholics, you're accusing us. You're constantly denouncing us. Do you know how many sermons I've heard on the subject of homosexuality in my entire life? One. At a Latin Mass in New York on Easter Sunday. And it was very ill-advised. I did not think Easter Sunday was a time for a sermon on the sodomy agenda of the New York Times. Again, sometimes the trads are kind of tone deaf. Easter Sunday was not the day. But I've heard one in my entire life.
I don't think I've heard any. So between the two of us, that's still one.
That's one sermon on the subject, yes. So it is not the Catholic Church. It is not the evangelical Christians who are condemning the people practicing sodomy and transgenderism. It is their own conscience.
Can I just say, there are going to be some people who may not have either the experience or the background that you and I think, quite clearly share, because I know that what you say is right for a whole series of reasons. But if they don't, and they think that perhaps you're driving a metaphor or an allegory too hard, it's not that we need to prove anything. It's simply that the fact that it is a historical fact that under the guise of certain progressive values, the same values are being reinvoked. You and I are claiming there's a metaphysical link. We would say we know that there is one, and the jots join perfectly. But even for those who are metaphysically hard of hearing, the dots still join up. It's still the same values, even if the progressives themselves don't understand that they are giving themselves to either philosophical, psychological entities that they respect. It's just we happen to believe and understand that the church is teaching that these psychological entities have a metaphysical ontology.
They don't know that they're being driven by demons. My metaphor for what's happening to the West right now is the Gadarene swine thundering towards the cliff. And I tell my fellow editors at The Stream, we are all Gadarene swine, but some of us have decided to run back uphill.
Right.
And it's not easy running back uphill when the rest of the herd is thundering towards the cliff. It's not that there are arguments persuading people of this agenda. Science did not discover that there were 47 genders when Bruce Jenner appeared on Vanity Fair magazine's cover in drag with great makeup and Photoshop. That was the cultural signal for people to say, oh, this is the new religion. This is the new gospel. This is what all fashionable people are following, and I don't want to be out of step. I pretended that I delivered a TED talk at Davos in the presence of George Soros and King Charles and Klaus Schwab, and I published it at The Stream. The title is There Is No You in Winter, and it was all about what it takes to join today's cultural elites. It doesn't take intelligence. It doesn't take advanced serious education. It doesn't take skill. It certainly doesn't take originality. What it takes is an infallible sense of the herd. You know which way the herd is going, and you get out in front so you can look like a leader. And you know how to cull those who are pushing in the wrong direction. You know how to discipline those who deviate one step to the left or right. So it's a herd mentality on steroids, thundering towards the cliff. And that's what we're facing. Science did not discover there were 47 genders. Bruce Jenner did a magazine cover, and scientists got the signal. You have to find studies to justify this. You have to come up with something that says, unless people are given transgender surgery, they're going to commit suicide. You have to find studies. And if any scientists disagree with you, we will cancel them. We will destroy their careers. We will make it impossible for them to work. Exactly what was done with the vaccine and the COVID pandemic.
And what's really surprised me is that whilst I realized that people don't like being unpopular, I had entirely underestimated the sociological pressures of crowd control or crowd conforming, because it seemed as I talked to otherwise intelligent people who would have shared my values 10 years ago, and then I say to them, exactly what is it in your knowledge of homosexuality or your understanding of the sociological contract of marriage or your understanding of the relationship between biology and gender? What is it that you rely on to adopt these new fashionable mores?
And they say, shut up.
Yeah, they say, shut up. That's right. And then at that point, you realize that the depth of fear that operates on people, the prospect of being left out of the crowd. We're back to the Gadarene swine again.
Whenever I see a mob going in one direction, I've always assumed they were the Gadarene swine thundering off a cliff. And so I'm born for this moment.
You know. Curiously enough, I mean, people have sometimes called me a contrarian, and I object to that because actually my life is spent juggling working hypotheses. I think, therefore, that one of the things that I do is to examine things, shake them to the point of destruction so that I know whether they'll bear the weight of reality or not.
But that is a good instinct. I have just an automatic reductio ad absurdum. Whenever someone gives ideas, my mind instantly follows them all the way down off the cliff. And then I just blurt out the final step and they're appalled. 10 years ago, nobody believed, if you had said 10 years ago, oh, by the way, they're going to be castrating little kids soon. And they'll be taking kids away from their parents if they don't want them castrated. You would have been called an insane alarmist nutcase. By the way, my favorite British novelists actually foresaw all this. Two of them. Anthony Burgess, in 1963, published a book called The Wanting Seed. It was an anti-utopian novel, dystopian. He called it cacotopian. And it imagined a future where socialist Malthusians control the West and enforce sterilization. And the dominant political class becomes, drumroll, homosexuals and eunuchs. Now, how crazy must that have seemed in 1963 when there were still American states where contraception was illegal? So kudos to Anthony Burgess. Kudos also to Yves Lenoir, who in his novella, Love Among the Ruins, predicted a socialist utopia where the Ministry of Euthanasia was the only popular government agency. And the anti-hero of the novel was a felon, repeat arsonist, who was housed in a former British aristocrat's house that had been seized for taxes. And his love interest was a hermaphrodite who'd been created by government experiments. So again, cranky, embittered British novelists with Catholic upbringings seem to be the prophets of the future.
And they got it exactly right. And again, I've been involved in speaking out against euthanasia for, I don't know, for a decade. And all the time we're saying, but you know that it will go too far. What progressive loosening of moral conscience has not gone too far? None of them have.
Yeah, let's look at the case in Belgium. Let's look at this case in Belgium. A young woman was the victim of a terrorist attack by Muslim immigrants. Why were there Muslim immigrants in Belgium? No one wants to ask that. They attacked the airport where her Catholic school was taking a trip. Several of her friends were killed. She was so traumatized that she developed clinical depression. The Belgian socialist medical establishment couldn't cure her. She was suicidal. So they euthanized her. There's no death penalty for the terrorists who blew up the airport, but there is for the victim. If you can't see that this is madness, then I really can't help you. You need a priest with holy water to exercise.
So that's a very helpful mise-en-scene. Thank you. Let's go back now to this great victory dance.
Let's remember Father James Martin was involved in planning this event. He has said he was invited, but he had travel commitments. So he knew what was happening. Father James Martin, who has been promoted to higher and higher positions with the Vatican while promoting the heresy that same-sex relationships can be recognized by the church.
Let me just ask you for a moment. These high sources in the Vatican that are promoting Father James Martin, they must know exactly what they're doing.
Yes, yeah. Let's use W.H. Auden's term for it. He called it the Haman term. It is an organized conspiracy of sexual radicals who want to remove the Christian understanding of sexuality and replace it with the postmodern one. John Gravino, I don't know if you're familiar with him, has got a great book called Confronting the Pope of Suspicion. And it analyzed Amoris Laetitiae, and it predicted everything that's happening now 5 years ago. And nobody paid attention to it. John Gravino is a Catholic philosopher. When Amoris Laetitiae was published, within a week, I wrote a piece saying this will lead to the political persecution of Christians, and it is intended to do so. In the United States, at least, we have a First Amendment protection of religious liberty. However, so let's say a gay couple goes to a priest and says, we want you to bless our relationship in church. We're going to have this fabulous event. We want to use your church because it's a beautiful Gothic pile. If that priest says no, they can sue him in court. Up until Amoris Laetitiae, that priest would have had an ironclad defense. My religion says I can't do this. Now they can go to court and say, your pope says you can do this. Therefore, your refusal to do it is evidence of bias, and we can sue you and sue your bishop. The bishop, afraid of a lawsuit, will then tell the priest to do it. So what this does, what Fiducia Supplicans and Amoris Laetitiae, what they do, they are giving the secular state the weapons it needs to root out faithful Catholic priests and bishops using the machinery of the state. Pope Francis is essentially using Leviathan to purge the church of his theological enemy.
When you wrote that, I borrowed it and credited you and said that John Smirnak has warned us. And the reason that I was very open to your argument was that for a long time in English politics, I've liked the way that one of our prominent Catholic politicians, a man called Jacob Rees-Mogg, handles this on the media. And so, but one of the attractions of becoming a Catholic was the idea of being able to use the Rees-Mogg defense. So Rees-Mogg, he's an old fogey. You like him or you loathe him, but he's quite bright. And he gets brought up to be the full guy on a number of different programs. And they always go for him on the issue of sexual morality. And he leans back and he says, I'm awfully sorry, but you're asking the wrong person. I'm just a humble Catholic who believes in the faith of the Catholic Church with 1.4 billion others. You need to address this question to the people who formulate our doctrine. It's beyond my pay grade. And of course, they can't then touch him or accuse him of the thought crimes that they would accuse evangelicals, Protestants, or conservatives. But now they can. The Jacob Rees-Mogg defense has gone, and so has the defense that Americans had under the Constitution, because the organization has changed the rules and made them vulnerable to lawsuits, which is beyond terrible.
And I made the argument in a piece at Chronicles Magazine entitled, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Francis? I made the argument that this is exactly what the Pope wanted. The Pope wants to use the state to purge the church of the people he sees as his theological enemies.
Now, my role in this conversation is now going to be to push back, because my editors will want me to say, quite rightly, they'll want me to say, wait a moment, so you have a guest who's proposing something really quite provocative at first sight. John, might he be doing this by accident? Could this be some form of Peronist chaos theory that's taking place in the kind of political maelstrom in the uncertain waters of the 21st century? Do we really have enough intention to lay this at the feet of Francis himself? Or is there a possibility there's a kind of confluence of different eddying waters?
It almost seems disrespectful to suggest that this could be happening by accident or incompetence. I have more respect for Pope Francis's intelligence than to think that after 10 years of this, he hasn't cottoned on to what results of his consistent pattern of decisions have been. If he really is doing all this by accident, then he's medical condition to the United States President Joe Biden, who is talking to François Mitterrand.
Let me ask you for help here, because that's a good argument. I hate conspiracy theories because they draw me too close to the world of madness. And I also hate looking like an idiot when I'm suckered. But the Pope is quite an elderly man, and this looks at first sight to be a staged strategy, as you say, beginning with in 2013 at the youth conference, "I like chaos, go and make a mess, kids, make me the messes." So this sounds like a kind of cool, hip granduncle trying to get down with the kids. And, you know, I thought it was an error. But how did he know he'd live this long? If it's being staged like this on purpose, and it is a coherent plan, you know, because something new is dropped every 2 years.
He's filled the College of Cardinals with ideological carbon copies of himself.
Is that going to work? Do we know that's going to work? Because are they ideological carbon copies? They're clearly people who are not out of sympathy with him.
I mean, people like Blaise Supich, who forbade priests to pray outside abortion clinics, who allowed Jesuit sexual molesters to live as chaplains at a local Catholic college without warning anyone. Blaise Supich, his response to the news that Planned Parenthood was selling baby parts for profit, essentially cannibalizing babies from abortions and selling them to medical labs. He wrote in the Chicago Tribune that while this is terrible, it's no more appalling than the U.S. government deporting illegal immigrants or Americans carrying guns or executing condemned criminals. Now, this was while he was still bishop, and now he's a cardinal. Antonio Spadaro, the Jesuit who, like 5 or 6 years ago, wrote a piece in La Civiltà Cattolica saying that the whole of the Christian right in America were simply repackaged white racists who were embittered by the desegregation of schools and churches and had reorganized in what he called the ecumenism of hate. He wrote that 7 years ago. More recently, he preached a sermon where he said that Jesus Christ committed the sin of racism in his encounter with the Syrophoenician woman, but that he repented. Less than 2 weeks later, he was appointed to a high position in the Vatican. If this is incompetence, it's incompetence out of a Three Stooges movie. It's something out of Duck Soup starring Groucho Marx. I just think it's actually disrespectful to Pope Francis as a human being to suggest that this is all an accident.
I love the Chestertonian tone of this. So we can have you on the side saying, this is clearly planned by the Pope. And you can have me saying, I'm not convinced. And then you can accuse me of disrespecting the Pope. I think that's a very fair trade-off in the conversation. I take your point entirely. And so here I am as the editor trying to defend Pope Francis and being invited to consider the disrespect that involves my showing him. But we'll leave it to the listeners to decide between the two positions we have. Take me back to St. Patrick's.
Yeah, all right. So I think the way to the historical analogy we should be using for this transgender celebration of prostitution and sodomy at the cathedral, this is like the Nazi SS jumping up and down in the ruins of a burning synagogue during Kristallnacht. I know that's provocative. It's intentionally so. I think there is a persecution of Christianity going on in the West that the state is behind, and that elements in the church are cooperating with because they want to purge the church of their internal enemies. There's ample historical precedent for this. St. Augustine called on the Roman Empire to persecute the Donatists. And the various Nestorians and Monophysites of the Byzantine Empire welcomed the invading Muslims as liberators from the oppressive state of the Byzantines. There's a long-standing, seemingly perennial temptation to call Caesar in to help you clear out your enemies within the church. What that does to the church and what's left of the church after that is usually not very pretty. And certainly the Reformation in England, we saw, is a tragic story of people repeatedly using an intolerant state to persecute their theological opponents. And the result is always a church that is under the control of the state.
As an ex-Anglican, that's true. As a man with badly repressed Donatist tendencies, I know what Augustine did. So what you're saying then is that the authorities in the cathedral were content to allow this platform to take place in order to pursue their political and theological agenda of the reconfiguration of sexuality in a way that contradicts Catholic mores.
Right. Cardinal Dolan has praised the priest in charge of this wretched spectacle. He has said he was a hero, something like that. Now, let me give you some background. I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up in New York, went to Catholic schools, lived in New York for most of my life. Back under Cardinal O'Connor, who himself was personally very orthodox and very zealous, holy man. He was not very good with finances. He wanted to bring the ministry Courage. Do you know the ministry Courage? It's for Catholics struggling against same-sex attraction, trying to lead holy lives. And the members of Courage are probably among the holiest people walking the earth today. And of course, they get very little sympathy in many church circles because a shockingly high percentage of the clergy are same-sex attracted. There was a study the U.S. bishops commissioned, and it came up with a range between 15% and 53% of priests in America are same-sex attracted. That's compared to 2% of the general population.
John, can I just, I go with 1.8%, but I'll allow two. Can I just ask you a question that as a Catholic convert, I've found myself dealing with, and I suspect you may know the answer. My information is that there was an influx of homosexuals into the Catholic Church from the 50s onwards, starting, you know, in the 60s and accelerating, and that you and I know, and this may be one of the few places we can say it, that there's a close link between ephebophilia and homosexuality. But of course, the progressive powers that be are desperate for that never to be spoken out loud and for the statistics to be shown. To what extent, if we know it at all, Does the discipline of celibacy, has it involved levels of homosexual presence within the priesthood over the ages? Obviously, there's going to be a vast series of variables, time, place, culture, whatever. But is it anything like what we've experienced in the last 60, 70 years?
I think what we've experienced recently has been worse. But I think in past centuries, there were good, bad reasons for a straight man to become a priest. It beats working in a coal mine and having 14 children, half of whom will die in infancy. It's the only way to get an education. It beats joining the army. It beats starving. I think in the past, a lot of straight men became priests and were willing to be celibate and follow the rules. And there were homosexuals who joined the priesthood, but there were very strong ascetical practices in place. People were flagellating themselves. People were fasting. They were using all the classical tools of self-control that have been known over the centuries in multiple religions, including Buddhism, for self-control. All these things were in place, and the culture was strongly, I would say, even homophobic. It was excessively hostile to homosexuality. So you had lots of straight men in the priesthood who had joined because it beat being a coal miner. Now there is no good, bad reason to become a priest. It is now a very attractive proposition for someone who feels, well, the church is telling me I have to be celibate anyway, since I only want to have sex with men. I have to be celibate. The church said so. Well, the church is offering me a salary for it and a job. And so I'll do it. And I think a lot of them join in all the good intentions of being celibate. Well, wait, this is 40, 50% other gay men. And the Vatican keeps sending us signals that they're going to change this and they're going to change that. They change the liturgy, language. What else are they going to change? Am I doing these ascetical practices, repressing my own sexuality for no good reason to obey some rule that's going to be changed 5 years down the road? This background that compared to 2% of the general population, the priesthood is at least 15%, but maybe 50% homosexual. Cardinal O'Connor, back in the 90s, wanted to bring Courage to have them have an office at the Archdiocesan headquarters at 1011 First Avenue. A gay activist approached someone at the Archdiocese and said, if you do this, we will publish the names of hundreds of actively homosexual priests whom we are sleeping with, who we know people are sleeping with. We will put it all in the newspapers. Cardinal O'Connor, that lion of orthodoxy, that pro-life hero, he had to back down. And this was almost 30 years ago. The balance of power is so much more in favor of the homosexual lobby now. I think Cardinal Dolan may be trying to prevent St. Patrick's from being burned down. There have been multiple shootings at churches by angry transgender activists in recent months. There's a great article at Revolver News, a great American news source people should look at, comparing the trans activists to the Janissaries. The Janissaries were young Greek and Balkan boys kidnapped by the Turks, forcibly converted to Islam, circumcised as teenagers, which is no picnic, and turned into the fanatical shock troops of the Ottoman Empire. This article says that the transgenders are being turned into the shock troops of the sexual revolution. They are mentally unbalanced. They have psychological problems. They're obviously unhappy in their own skins. They're alienated. They're being encouraged to think that they were born in the wrong body. What an insanely dangerous Gnostic idea to tell someone you were born in the wrong body. And it's society's duty to pretend that you are the opposite sex, to pay for surgeries and hormones to make you into the opposite sex. And anyone who doesn't agree and doesn't use your pronouns is committing a hate crime. That is a recipe for creating terrorists. And we have transgender terrorists attacking churches right now. Cardinal Dolan may be simply trying to prevent his cathedral from being burned down. And let's remember, it was only about 150 years ago that angry Protestant mobs wanted to burn down St. Patrick's Cathedral for very different reasons.
Well, that's a compelling analysis, and it's hard to falsify it. It certainly has to be taken into consideration. So let's leave him with the benefit of the problematic argument that the end justifies the means. But let's go to Rupnik first, because on the back of sexual confusion, sexual degradation, the moving of the boundaries of what is and isn't sexually acceptable, and as you were saying earlier on, the thing that I personally perhaps have the greatest difficulties with as a Catholic convert, and let me just say, I'm thrilled to be a Catholic. I'm sorry it took me so long. I'm absolutely in right to the bitter end. But nonetheless, there are one or two things I have against the church, as it says in the book of the Apocalypse. One of them is the way in which sex offenders are being unnecessarily defended by senior sources in the Vatican. Let's go to Rupnik.
It's astonishing to me that when bishops like the one in Puerto Rico are getting removed because they wouldn't segregate the unvaccinated for Holy Communion. That's why a bishop was removed, because he wouldn't ostracize people who refused to take what I call the dead baby vaccine, because it was made using cannibalized organs from aborted babies. As everyone admits, they wouldn't take the vaccine. He refused to make them get in a separate communion line as if they were plague carriers. And so he was removed from office. Bishop Strickland was removed from office in Texas, according to the papal nuncio, for putting too much emphasis on the deposit of faith, because that's not really what Pope Francis is interested in.
Well, and slight errors of maladministration, which have not yet come to light.
Right, right. But I'm sure if there was dirt, they would have used it.
So that's just the English. That's the English way of saying he was completely innocent and his hands were totally clean. I was just wrapping it up in understatement again. Sorry. Sorry for the transatlantic confusion.
I'm sorry. I'm not just an American, I'm half Irish, so I have to really struggle to speak British.
Okay, so speaking British, there were a few matters of maladministration of a minor kind which have yet come to light and are unlikely to see the light of day in the near future.
Exactly. Okay, thank you. So if you won't segregate the unvaccinated, you will be moved as bishop. But Father Rupnik, we are now hearing testimony from nuns he sexually molested using, I hate to even say this, the chalice from Mass as a receptacle of body fluids. This is out of Aleister Crowley. This is out of the Marquis de Sade. This man's art still adorns churches at the Vatican. It still adorns, Vatican publications are still using Rupnik's crude, juvenile parodies of Byzantine art on their publications.
I was reading somebody, and it may even have been you, who made the important point that if you actually look at the art, one of the things that characterizes it is the appallingly dead eyes, which are horrifyingly and chillingly aesthetically communicative of what dead eyes represent.
I call his style adrenochrome primitivism.
Okay, that sounds very good.
I'll defend Eric Gill's art, because Eric Gill was a pervert, but at least his art is decent. I don't think they should pull down Eric Gill's Stations of the Cross.
Sure, but this is such a big and important subject, particularly for Catholics, about the extent to which someone's private life undermines the authenticity or the integrity of their artistic gift.
Well, with Rupnik, we don't have that problem because the stuff is awful. And I did a piece at stream.org. I hope people will go read. It's called Tide Pod Vestments and Child Abuse. I argue that the purposely primitivist art to which we've been subjected since Vatican II is intentional. It's intended to lower the psychological stakes, to take away the fear of sin, to take away any anxiety about your own salvation, because eternal damnation were really possible. If really your soul could be lost for all eternity, would people be dressed this foolishly? Would we be having these ridiculous banners that looked like they were done by untalented, resentful four-year-olds? No, clearly no. If you're going to have Barney the dinosaur up on the altar, if you're going to be playing the chicken dance when you distribute Holy Communion, by the way, I didn't make that last one up. All of this is by way of saying, don't worry. Sin doesn't exist. There is no hell. Do whatever you want. Relax. And I can't think of a worse message to send priests who are tempted to molest boys than there is no hell. Whatever you do, relax. It doesn't matter. There's no accident that the abuse epidemic happened at the same time that our liturgies and our art were being dumbed down and vulgarized and primitivized and made ridiculous. This man sexually molested nuns in rituals that can only be called satanic. Even the Jesuits were forced to discipline this man. Let's think about that. Even the Jesuits had to throw this guy under the bus. That's pretty bad. The Vatican intervenes to put him back in the priesthood. The Vatican keeps using his art. Would they use the art of Arno Breker, Hitler's sculptor? They might use Soviet art. I would not put it past them. But this is a signal. This is a signal. This is Pope Francis being loyal to someone who's on his side. One thing you can't accuse him of is disloyalty to his allies. We conservatives tend to be like crabs in a bucket. We'll throw each other under the bus at the drop of a hat. Theological left, the political left, they don't do that. They stick together. There are no enemies to the left. And so the scandal of Rupnik as a priest in good standing, while Bishop Strickland has been removed from office for unspecified administrative incompetence, again, that sends a signal. It sends a signal to Caesar. It sends a signal to the government who they should pick on. The RFBI has been infiltrating Latin Mass congregations with the brief that you're to find evidence of domestic terrorism. Meanwhile, when a transgender person shoots up a church, his manifesto is kept secret from the public. This is not an accident. This is a pattern. You have to be a conspiracy theorist to deny that there's a pattern behind it.
That's absolutely true, and a perfectly reasonable juxtaposition of facts that have been in the public space over the last few years. I agree. One of the objections I have to the conspiracy theory, in order only not to keep myself from going mad, not because I refuse to entertain it, is that it's kind of in the water, that the sociological pressures are all aligning in one way or another. And there isn't somebody in the background planning this and executing it, but there's a kind of topographical confluence.
I don't think it's 13 rabbis or 14 Freemasons or 6 gay Jesuits. It's demons. It's principalities and powers that are orchestrating this. You don't need a human conspiracy.
I mean, intellectually, theologically, metaphysically, I have no objection to that. It's the least problematic explanation.
So I don't demonize my enemies. I'm angry at the demons who are giving them their instructions.
Are demonizing them. Yes, you're angry they're being demonized by the demons.
That's right. That's right. I want these people to be liberated from the principalities and powers that are whispering in their heads and are herding them like the Gadarene swine over the cliff.
Why do so many intellectuals have such difficulty in even hypothesizing the existence of metaphysical entities that are characterized by ethical positions? Because you only have to mention the idea of the demonic or the spiritual or the corrupt angelic, and and people want to have you committed within nanoseconds.
Oh, see, that's a difference. Here in America, it's still respectable to talk about that, and enough people have seen the movies of demonic possession.
So I mean, I haven't seen the movies, but I've had the personal experience, and indeed,
I'd say see the movie The Exorcism of Emily Rose. It's a very good dramatization of a real exorcism story from the 1970s in Germany. It's very powerful. Well, what I would say to these people is, okay, how do you explain Auschwitz?
Yeah, absolutely. It was Auschwitz that propelled me as an adolescent into the potential waiting room of becoming a converted Christian. Because as with so many other people, I found it much easier to believe in the devil than I did in the God, because it was impossible to believe that human beings could have done this on their own. And so the notion of Auschwitz was one of the things that prepared me for a metaphysical universe in which I was going to have to take sides.
Right. Pope Pius XII, when he was still a cardinal, warned the U.S. ambassador to Britain, Joseph Kennedy, that Roosevelt should not try to make any kind of deal with Adolf Hitler, because Adolf Hitler was perfectly possessed. Perfect possession is where your head's not spinning, you're not spewing green vomit, you are possessed and you're happy with it. You're not fighting it. In fact, it makes you feel empowered. And I think if you want to start, say, well, can we agree that maybe one person in the history of the human species was possessed? And if one could be possessed, maybe more than one could be possessed. There's no rational explanation for the Holocaust. The Jews were not, in fact, a threat to Germany. There was no reason for the Nazis to be using trucks they needed on the Eastern Front, to be taking Jewish doctors and scientists and killing them in camps, rather than even putting them to work. That level of irrational, hateful evil is pretty easy to demonstrate. I have experienced the presence of what I think was personal demonic evil in two contexts. When I've prayed outside abortion clinics, I have felt that personal demonic presence. And when I've encountered violent anti-Semites, I get the same feeling.
That's very interesting. I haven't had the first, but I've been absolutely convinced that the anti-Semitism in the world, the irrational, improper hatred of God's chosen people, has to be more than political, xenophobic, racist. Apart from anything else, it transcends all those boundaries into a kind of confluence that only makes sense if you put it in a metaphysical context. So I agree entirely with you. The difficulty I have, at least in this country, is that it's extremely difficult to have this conversation in educated circles.
If these people claim to be Christians, what do they make of the passages in the Bible which say Jesus drove out demons?
Oh, I know. I can answer that because I spent 20 years as a liberal. I want to talk to clergy about this. I remember the awkwardness I felt as I looked up the passages of Mass when preaching, and two things that I found profoundly awkward. I remained orthodox creedally, but I would say in terms of human morals and ethics, I was an early defender of the LGBTQ+ agenda. I was working at Britain's gayest university. But the answer is you have to go to great uncomfortable lengths to sidestep them in some way or another in order to find a reductionist explanation that is at odds with what they clearly appear to be and completely at odds with the cumulative effect of the struggle against evil in the Gospels.
How about Jesus in the desert being tempted? Are we supposed to believe Jesus was schizophrenic and he was hearing voices?
Well, the progressive position simply says, well, this is allegorical or metaphorical, or it's highly poetic language in a culture that you know better. I mean, the obvious one they've always used, of course, is that they mistook epilepsy. Jesus was just going around being a psychiatrist and delivering people from some sort of neurological condition that they didn't understand at the time and called demons. I mean, that is the crass but populist way in which liberal Protestant clergy, anyway, deal with most of this.
So Jesus came to save us all from becoming epileptics in the next life.
Oh, absolutely. Clearly, that's because that's what the Gospels show you. Yes. And isn't it a good thing that the church is on top of epilepsy nowadays? It just goes to show you how much like Jesus we are.
Yeah. Thank God for the NHS.
Oh, well, that's why we worship it.
The NHS, I've joked that the NHS is the new established religion.
It is. It's not even, that's not a joke at all.
In a sense, it's totally understandable. This institution protects us. It keeps us alive. It feeds us like a nurturing mother. And when it's determined that our lives are of no more use, it offers us a gentle, painless exit. It's like a mama bird. It regurgitates into our beak, and we're grateful.
We could go down the road of why we want an abusive mama goddess in our society. Let me take you back to the American Episcopate, if I can, for a moment.
Yes. Okay, so here's the problem. There are a lot of American bishops who are personally Catholic. There are bishops in America who are Catholic. I just want to let people know that this is the case. There are several, and maybe two dozen, who are personally Catholic, as opposed to the others. They are financially dependent on a pyramid scheme. The U.S. Catholic bishops have reaped $3 billion in the last 15 years smuggling immigrants into the country, basically. Getting illegal immigrants in, getting them government benefits. Our bishops, through organizations like Catholic Charities, have nonprofit contracts with the federal government to take care of these immigrants. So they make a profit on it. I did a review of a wonderful movie about Mother Cabrini called Cabrini. It's out and I recommend it to everyone. It's all about how the church in the 19th century, using her own money, well, took legal immigrants who were being treated badly in America and set up hospitals and schools for them. My own mother passed away at Mother Cabrini Hospice in New York City. So this was a beautiful legacy of the corporal works of mercy being done by the church on the church's own money and own labor. What's happening now is the U.S. church has become a department of the federal government, and it just processes these immigrants, takes a nice cut, $3 billion in 15 years. Every dollar the U.S. bishops had to pay out in sex abuse judgments has been made back through this immigration business. So this is why the U.S. bishops, when Trump was president, weren't happy that he was doing pro-life things. They were upset that he was closing the border. Because every time an illegal immigrant swims the Rio Grande, the bishops cash a check. They don't cash a check when a woman decides to keep her baby. If we could find some way of financially incentivizing the Catholic Church to what every time a woman doesn't have an abortion, they get a check, you would see a surge of pro-life activity among our bishops. So our bishops, even the good ones, are told, if the U.S. enforces its immigration laws, you're going to have to close these seven parishes. You're going to have to close these hospitals. These hospitals will be sold to secular companies that will do abortions in them and transgender surgeries in them. So do you want that on your conscience? So as a result, our bishops are politically terrified of the victory of the Republicans because it would bankrupt them. So essentially, our bishops have given up on Catholics born in America, raised as Catholic. 4 out of 10 Catholics who grow up in America leave the church and never return. 4 out of 10. If 4 Toyotas out of 10 exploded when you put them in park, somebody would lose his job. But that's not what happens. The U.S. bishops are content to just steal sheep from Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras. They fill up the pews. Now, they leave too. Most of these immigrants won't be Catholic in 10 years. At the moment, less than 50% of Hispanics in America consider themselves Catholic. What a great job these bishops are doing. Even the immigrants they import from these impoverished countries don't stay Catholic for long. Why? Maybe because 15 to 50% of priests are swishing around in the sanctuary and highly effeminate, and these Hispanic men are not into that. They go to the local Pentecostalist church where they drive out demons, they preach the gospel, and God bless them, some of them vote Republican. As a patriot, I can't be too upset when these Honduran immigrants go over to a Pentecostalist church to get away from the gay Jesuits, because at least they might vote pro-life and pro-American, and they might actually hear the gospel instead of getting liberation theology, and they won't have Father Rupnik's pictures on their missalettes.
Wow, John, that's hard for me to hear as an enthusiastic new Catholic, but I agree with you. I think those are the values of the kingdom of heaven. And there are moments in the history of the church when the values of the kingdom and the values of the church do not align as perfectly as we want them to. Maybe this is one of those moments.
It's really hard for me. I've written multiple Catholic apologetics books, and I don't know what to say now. I mean, I my joke is I tell evangelical Protestants, abandon the chaos of private interpretation. Join our hierarchical church and help us defend the teachings of our previous authorities from our current authority. And they don't get a lot of takers.
No, that's I've been moving around to that position too, in it, because I think it's the only one one could take. One has to say you need to be free from the anarchy of private interpretation. It certainly won't offer you any safety in the cultural crisis that we face at the moment. But it's extremely difficult to make a case for the ways in which the value of the hierarchy of the church align with what Catholicism has taught in all times and in all places.
I think we should stop talking about the magisterium. Just the magisterium is so poorly defined, we should stop talking about it and talk instead about the deposit of faith.
In order to balance the ultramontanism of the last 150 years that developed, I think, too far in fear of what's taken place in Europe ideology during that time, is the magisterium. But you want to, there needs to be a stronger magisterium in order to counterbalance what we're experiencing in the Vatican and in the See of St. Peter.
The problem is the magisterium has come to mean the Vatican party line. There's a kind of Catholic Stalinism abroad where what the Pope is essentially like Stalin in 1936. I don't know if you've ever read the great novel Darkness at Noon by Arthur Kessler, who's an ex-communist. And in that book, it's all through the mind of an early Bolshevik who's caught up in Stalin's purges. And he doesn't understand. He knows he didn't spy for Nazi Germany and the Vatican simultaneously, which he's been accused of and he's going to be executed for in Moscow. But he's being told, you need to confess to this, because whatever Comrade Stalin and the Soviet Communist Party is doing at the moment is what the dialectic of history demands. That kind of Stalinism is what's being asked towards the papacy now. Whatever previous popes have said, it doesn't matter. Pope Francis can contradict all his predecessors and the covenant of Noah on capital punishment. And whatever he's saying at the moment is what you're supposed to believe. Maybe your grandson will be taught the opposite, and then he should believe that.
So what I'd assumed would happen would be that because of this abuse of the magisterium that's taking place at the moment, some development of understanding of what was authentic magisterium and what was not was inauthentic magisterium needed to take place. And you're saying this might happen by moving the emphasis onto the deposit of faith.
Yes, we should talk about the deposit of faith. And there is actually a problem in the documents of Vatican II, in Lumen Gentium. There's a passage, I don't remember which, there's a passage which says every Catholic should offer religious submission to the statements of the Pope, even when they're not infallible. And to me, that crosses the line. That needs to be fixed. A future council needs to fix that.
I agree. That's Stalinism. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Well, the last 2 minutes, I think, are perhaps the most pregnant moments we've spoken about, because they offer some hope. And also they offer a platform upon which you can invite people to join the Catholic Church if this is the task that we might try and pursue. Let me ask you very briefly what you think is going to happen in the next conclave.
On one level, I'm tempted to say I hope a meteorite, while a few Africans are still changing planes, and then there are only like two or three cardinals left, and they're all from Africa. It may be that the chaos that has erupted in the past 10 years will sober people. I hope that the voices of the persecuted church in Africa and Asia and the Middle East are heard louder than the voices of the gangrenous church, the church of gangrene. I mean, I think, honestly, it's kind of a scandal that we have so many cardinals from countries where no one goes to mass. I think countries where there's a less than 10% weekly attendance rate should be stripped of their cardinals. They shouldn't even have bishops. They should be mission territories. So I think Germany should be a mission territory of Cameroon. Belgium should be a mission territory of Congo. Britain should be a mission territory of Nigeria. Ireland should be a mission territory of the various areas of Africa where the Irish Holy Ghost Fathers once preached. It would be a great humbling experience for the European church to be only have the level of influence it deserves, and it earns it by zeal and actual practice of the faith. If the Cardinal Daniels, who presided over the collapse of the church in their countries, if they're allowed to elect another pope in their image, then I think you're going to see a split. You're going to see the faithful bishops eventually walk away, and they're going to elect another pope. There will be two popes. There will be a schism. And that all those who adhere to the theology of Aleister Crowley and Father Rupnik and Cardinal Tucho, they will lose interest. Just they will be end up being effective Unitarians. And the zealous ones who hold to the depositive faith will be the smaller, purer church that Pope Benedict predicted.
Well, very interestingly, what you've described is what's happened within Anglicanism. The conservative Africans are the ones who are sending evangelists and missionaries, and even now Episcopal and theological structures. In fact, that's what I was partly involved in before I became a Catholic. It founders on the basis there is no magisterium.
If there is such a split, I just want to remind people, there is ready and waiting in Ivory Coast. They have a replica of St. Peter's. And I think that will be used.
I'm going to ask you to give a public message to Bishop Strickland, because you were very helpful to me a few months ago. I was invited to speak at a gathering in which, after I had accepted, an anti-Semite was given a place of honor and a number of us withdrew. It's the first time I've ever been involved in cancelling myself from an organization, but I had to because of the duplicity of bringing somebody in I wouldn't have agreed to share a platform otherwise. But Bishop Strickland's in the same position, and you want to hope this podcast is going to meet him. Do you want to explain your advice to him?
Right, and I'm going to be writing a column called "Bishop Strickland, Please Don't Board the Hindenburg." Bishop, the fellow who organized that conference, Patrick Coffin, the conference to which you were invited, and then he later brought on a Holocaust denier who does broadcasts denying the Holocaust on Iranian TV, and you were sandbagged, and all the other innocent speakers were sandbagged, and Patrick Coffin doubled down and defended the guy. He'd even done podcasts with the guy talking about the pernicious influence of Jews in 2019. This guy, Patrick Coffin, was sort of an entrepreneur, let's say. He lost a lot of money, I think, over that conference because a lot of the most prominent people like you withdrew. Now he's organizing a cruise to Catholic pilgrimage sites in Europe, and he got Bishop Strickland to agree to be the chaplain. And now he's billing it as the Bishop Strickland Show with Patrick Coffin. So Bishop Strickland is the headliner, and he's hoping to attract lots of people to pay several thousand dollars to cruise around to Marian shrines. But he's the same guy who had the Holocaust denier speaking at his last conference. How does Bishop Strickland know that at the last minute, this Holocaust denier is not going to be invited on the cruise too, or someone else? Who knows what unsavory extremist Patrick Coffin is going to invite at the last minute? And the association with a promotion with someone who promotes Holocaust denial is going to damage Bishop Strickland, and rightly so. And it's going to damage everyone like me who rallied to Bishop Strickland when he was unjustly removed as Bishop of Tyler, Texas. So I call upon Bishop Strickland to kick the dust from his feet and not sail on the Hindenburg.
It can be very easy to be drawn into organizations and gatherings where you find yourself cross-pollinated with people whose views you wouldn't otherwise share. What influence can Bishop Strickland be expected to play in the near future? I mean, obviously a kind of loyal opposition. There are a number of bishops who've been disaccommodated of their sees or who've lost their flats in Rome. Is there a kind of gathering of people who you rather delicately described as who are at least in their hearts personally Catholics earlier on? Is there some kind of reconfiguration of Orthodox Catholicism amongst the people who've fallen a prey to the present regime?
I think in America, it's going to be aligned with supporters of Donald Trump. I mean, ironically, Trump is a very imperfect person. I've compared him to Constantine, who was a politically Machiavellian and ruthless figure, but did in the end serve the church's interests, or to Charlemagne, who on the one hand was sponsoring the rebirth of Christian culture across Europe, on the other hand had multiple wives. So I don't think Trump rises to the level of a Constantine or a Charlemagne, but maybe he's a Charles Martel. Charles Martel was a brutal feudal warlord, but he did stop the Saracens from conquering France.
Well, I'm rereading, but reading properly this time, Tom Holland's book on Millennium. I've just got to the bit where Charlemagne crowns the Pope. I love the idea that he's a form of neo-Trump in reverse. Of course, people who suffer from Trump derangement syndrome are going to run away screaming at the moment. You've said something almost impossible for them to digest. So you're proposing as a kind of neo-Constantine that Trump and those of a conservative moral outlook will find themselves political allies.
Yeah, in fact, should Trump be permitted to take office, if they don't imprison him or assassinate him, if he doesn't meet the fate of Alexei Navalny in Russia, there's one thing he could do that would really help the Catholic Church. And this is going to sound perverse. Stay with me. He could start what we call a RICO investigation. That's a racketeer influence corrupt organization investigation into the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops for their gross mishandling of sex abuse. If he did that overnight, they would become ineligible for the $3 billion that they've been getting. They wouldn't be able to get any more money from the government. That would instantly take away their incentive to align with the political left. It would bankrupt the Catholic left, the professional left-wing activists who currently are soaking up money through groups like Catholic Charities. They would have to get real jobs serving French fries at fast food restaurants, which is what they're really qualified for. Best thing a future Republican president could do for America, for the church in America, would be to cut off the bishops from the government teat so that they cease to be agents of Caesar.
John, this has been one of the most interesting conversations I've had for a very long time. I expect we'll need to put a trigger warning for apoplectics at the beginning so that anyone suffering from blood pressure issues doesn't listen to more than the first half. I've loved talking to you. Thank you so much for bringing your experience, your wit, your wisdom, and your incisive judgment to this. It's not going to please people, but we're not here to please people. We're here to make them think, and then after they started thinking, to pray.
Could I plug one of my books, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism? I lay all this out. It's 5 years old, so a lot has happened since then, but The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism is where I try to synthesize all this into some kind of sane approach to keeping your faith intact in this time of auto-persecution of the church.
It was almost the first book I read after being received into the Catholic Church. I love it. It's become one of my favorite books. I do hope people will buy it. You're quite right. It's all in there. It tells the truth in an imaginative, invigorating way. It's a great book. I'm just hoping to get a signed copy one day. John Zmierak, thank you very much indeed. God bless you.